wanted to let you get comfortable so that you can get uncomfortable. No. All right. Case number three. 12, 12, 12. Wow. Okay. Acute care versus United States. Come on up, Mr. Redding. Wow, 12, 12, 12.
I'd just like to make a comment. You started out with a comment that it's the beginning of another school year. I'd like to note that it is also my first appearance in the Seventh Circuit. And hopefully this is a graduate school year, because I've been trying to sort out TEFRA partnership procedural law for 30 years, and I hope to retire later this year.
Oh, my.
So those thoughts went through my head.
We're not going to, you know, move that retirement along.
Your Honor, if I may, actually, one of the main reasons I'm not retired yet is so that we could see these through. So. Your Honor,
welcome to the Seventh Circuit.
Thank you.
Where everyone is as pleasant as we are.
Very good. Your Honor, if you please the court, I'd like to start out by there are so many threads in this case that it becomes a Gordian knot. I'd like to go back to the central issue, and that's the primary in this issue in this case, is whether 7422H barred the district court from exercising its otherwise established jurisdiction over refund claims to hear the appellant's statute of limitations and penalty interest refund claims. And that hinges on the nature of the claim and whether or not it is within the prohibition of 7422H, which is limited to refunds attributable to partnership items as defined in Section 6231. If I may, that is a narrow definition, and I think that the expansion of that by the lower court is in error, and it can be demonstrated by the language of TEFRA on its face.
Okay, now I hope this question relates to what you've been saying.
I'm sorry.
Because it does seem inherently correct that the question of whether the tax matters partner and the IRS entered into an agreement to extend the statute of limitations doesn't vary from partner to partner. And I would like to know what your bottom line argument is that it does.
My bottom line argument on that, Your Honor, is that element of a statute of limitations defense would in fact be a partnership item. But that goes to the defense the government should raise. And the government should have established that in the TEFRA proceeding so that it can come now into the statute of limitations refund claim and say, here's a determination that under 6229, the 6501 statute had been extended. It cannot now, because of 7422H, come to the court and say, we would like this court to make a determination as to whether or not there was an extension of the statute of limitations.
Look, the government on page 32 of its brief cites about six circuits for the proposition that courts of appeals have consistently held that a limitation challenge is a challenge to a partnership item. Have any courts held otherwise?
No, Your Honor. Would you repeat that?
If I can. Okay. Beginning with Kaplan, I'm going to just read it. The courts of appeals have consistently held that a limitation challenge to an assessment attributable to a partnership implicating what the partnership did, such as the one taxpayer seeks to raise here, is a challenge to a partnership item that cannot be maintained in a partner-level refund action?
Yes, Your Honor, I can address that. And the answer is that in the development of TEFRA procedural law for many years, the courts treated 6229 as if it was an independent statute of limitations. And as we did in Wiener, and as with the plaintiff's counsel did in Kaplan, they came to the court and said, we wish to establish, we want this court to look at the partnership level facts and determine that 6229 barred the assessment. And it cannot do that. Wiener was correct. Kaplan was correct. But as the courts have refined their interpretation of the statute, they have said, and Kirschbeck is directly on point on this, that 6229 does not create an independent TEFRA statute of limitations. What it creates are potential extensions of the statute of limitations created under 6501, the non-partnership statute, and that the ultimate statute of limitations may in fact vary from partner to partner, as it did in Kaplan. In Kaplan, other partner statutes had run. His was held to be open because he was subject to an extended statute of limitations. I think it was for failure to file a return, personally. The ultimate statute of limitations is what I call an affected item, what the courts call an affected item. It is ultimately a determination that requires a partner-level fact-finding and may involve determinations that should have been made at the partnership level as well. The thing is, the extension, historically, under all of the circuits, when the taxpayer, outside of TEFRA, let's look at the rule on 6501, when a taxpayer comes to the court and says the assessment was made after limitations ran, I'm asserting 6501. The courts have all said the burden then shifts to the government to establish an exception. If he can show that the assessment was outside the normal limitations period, it is the government's duty to show that there was, in fact, an extension or an exception. And in these cases, the government did not obtain any ruling in the TEFRA proceedings that there was, in fact, an extension of the statute of limitations in these partnerships, or, as it argued in the 84s, that the partnership tax returns were not, in fact, valid tax returns. Those determinations were not made. They're not in the decision. And the government can't come to the court now and say, make them for us. So what the lower court has done is said, we don't have jurisdiction over your 6501 refund claim that we have exercised jurisdiction over for 70 years because we're prohibited from hearing the government's argument as to its defense. And that's just wrong.
As to what?
As to its defense, defense to the claim. And that also, that's the answer to that question. And that goes to
Wait. Okay. Let me just make certain I have this right. What you're arguing right now is that the extension of the limitations period in 6229 is an affirmative defense to the limitations period in 6501. Is that,
yes, ma'am.
That's what you're saying?
Yes, ma'am. That it's an extension of 6501.
But the two together make up the limitations period.
No more.
And they act together in concert. So how can you argue that one applies to and involves partnership matters and the other one does not?
Your Honor, my answer to that is very simply, it's the same as it's always been. Any extension works in concert with what it's extending. If you look at one of the 6501 exceptions or extensions and say, is proof that the partner filed a return with a substantial understatement of income on it, creating a six-year statute, an extension of 6 years. Doesn't that work in concert with 6501? Surely it does. It doesn't change the fact that it is a defense to the 6501 statute. The problem here is the TEFRA bifurcates, and this court recently adhered to a strict interpretation of the bifurcation between affected items, partnership items, and the need to establish the proper elements of each at the proper stage. What was the recent case that just came out?
American Boat.
Yeah.
American Boat. And that's exactly what American Boat was about. And in that case, what it did is said, Normally, a partner can't assert a reasonable reliance defense in the partnership level because he can't appear, he can't make that defense. It's reserved to the individual partner. But where the defense was being made that, in fact, the reasonable reliance was in his capacity as the managing partner, that argument could be made. It sounds like splitting hairs, but it's the way TEFRA works. There is a very, very fine line distinction between where a partnership level issue can be resolved and where it cannot. And in any final assessment of the taxpayer, it's very related to the determinations at the partner level and the partnership level. They're always intricately related. You have to take the determinations that are final at the partnership level under TEFRA and then apply them to the partner. And in some cases, for example, if there's then an at-risk or an at-risk limitation, you have to look at that as to whether or not the full amount was claimed. You have to look at that as to whether or not he was entitled to even claim the full amount at the partner level. Let me compare it also to two other circuit court cases. Provachenko in the Fed Circuit and Monty, I think, was in the Ninth Circuit, where the partner was assessed following TEFRA, and the partner came to the court in a refund claim and said, that assessment was in error because I should have been entitled to a consistent settlement with other partners, and the government refused to give it to me. Those were held to be not refund claims attributable to partnership items. Those claims were based on the government's misconduct in assessing and rejecting their request for a consistent settlement. 6501, properly interpreted, should be the same way. Based on 70 years of tax precedent, 6501 is a basis on which the taxpayer can claim a refund. And the potential extensions of that 6501 created in TEFRA are, in fact, TEFRA partnership procedural items. They are partnership items. We agree. We agree with what Kaplan said. In Kaplan, the partner came and said, I want you to determine that the TMP had no authority to have acted, that the TMP's extension was invalid. Those were assertions by the plaintiff that he was asking the court to make determinations. And the court says, no, we can't. We're prohibited by 7422H from making new determinations at the partnership level. That's correct. The same thing was true in Wiener, where following historic interpretation up until Roan-Polnick in the tax court and then subsequently Kirsbeck in the Fifth Circuit, the concept was the 6229, and the government had argued 6229 was an independent statute of limitations, created an independent statute. All the courts that have looked at it have now rejected that. But at least in Pratty, it then kind of rolls past it and goes to this. But they're intricately related and work together, and therefore we're going to say it's a partnership item. Statute of limitations cannot be a partnership item. It can't, because there are elements that have to be determined at the partner level. And, in fact, at the partner level, it may result that the statute is even longer than it would have been based under the TEFRA extension.
If your argument is very clever, if we buy it, won't we be the only court that has ever made that determination?
It's not that it's very clever, Your Honor. It follows 70 years of tax history. I understand. And like I said, I've lived 30 years trying to sort out TEFRA. I believe it is the proper analysis. Would it be the only court? I don't know. We're going back to the Fifth Circuit on this now. The courts changed, and this has been an evolving area. As I said, up until 2000, the perception was those were separate statutes of limitations, which is why we pled it that way in Wiener. The Kirsbeck case in the Fifth Circuit was one of the first to very, very clearly say, but wait a minute. That's not a separate statute. You can't say that the statute under 6229 has run, and therefore it's barred. because your individual statute under 6501 is still open, and all 6229 does is potentially extend to that. And if your 6501 statute is still open, the assessment is still good. And in fact, in order to make that assessment, if one partner has an open statute under 6501, in order to assess related to partnership items, the government still has to issue the FPAW. The TEFRA proceeding may or may not proceed, or it may default, and then they can go forward. It still requires the TEFRA proceeding, even though that entire process may relate to only one partner.
How do you respond to the government's argument that you accepted the benefit of the settlement, but now, nonetheless, you're seeking to avoid the imposition of the agreed-upon tax-motivated interest by pursuing your own partnership-level refunds?
That's a complex question. Number one, these partners never agreed to a settlement. There was a decision imposed in the TEFRA proceeding, which, first, doesn't apply at all if, in fact, they weren't parties to the proceeding because of 6226. The statute says they cannot be if their limitations period ran. So that comes back on whether or not it was limitations, but assume for the moment that they were parties to the proceedings, and they were for the 86 years. There's no question about that. The TMP entered into settlement discussions with the government, which were incorporated into and entered as a decision by the court. The content of that decision is binding on these partners if they were parties. It is binding on them for 86. Now, the tax matters partner has only limited settlement authority independent of that, and in fact can't bind these partners to non-partnership item settlements, which would be the affected item. The question is, and it's a res judicata analysis, does that decision contain a determination that permits the imposition of penalty interest? Does it contain a determination that the transaction was a tax-motivated transaction? If it does, the assessment is correct. If it does not, then the assessment is void of grounds for the assessment. There is no basis upon in the decision that assessment. And as the judge said in Duffy, and by the way, the lower court, I think, misinterprets Duffy. But as the court said in Duffy, in a refund suit regarding penalty interest following a TEFRA proceeding, there are two things the partner can raise. One is whether or not the $1,000 computational threshold was met. That's partner-level issue purely. The second is whether or not there was a TMT determination. And then she went on and reviewed the decision in that case and concluded, as a matter of fact-finding in that case, that there was a TMT determination. We lost the case. We have different evidence in this case. We think it calls for a different analysis. The court below in this circuit, in this district court, said, I won't go to that analysis, that you're barred from raising the claim. Well, that's not what Duffy said. It is what Pratty said in the Fed Circuit. But Pratty does exactly what I started out saying should not be done. It takes the language of 7422H and expands it beyond partnership items. And I do want to very strongly want to make this point. Nobody doubts that penalty interest and limitations are affected items. They're issues that ultimately involve both partner level and partnership level determinations. Every place the code intended to refer to both refunds attributable to partnership items and affected items, it specifically said so. And I've cited that in the brief. There are numerous code sections where it says partnership items and affected items. It did not do so in 7422H. And in fact, in a section the government relies on, 6230D6, in 1997, that statute covered attributable to partnership items and affected items. The 97 amendments from those years forward, in order to make it more restrictive, Congress removed the parenthetical reference to and affected items and now makes it apply only to refunds attributable to partnership items. Well, if the removal of that phrase in 6230d6 doesn't sustain my position that the absence of that phrase in 7422h means the same thing, it means that section is limited to things directly attributable to partnership items, not to things attributable to affected items. Under any rules of statutory construction, that should be followed. And it makes sense if you understand the entire layout of TEFRA, because refund claims, and even in the legislative history, there's a provision that says after the TEFRA assessments, if the taxpayer has an overpayment, however it's defined, he can raise a refund claim for it.
Thank you, Mr. Redding.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, Mr. Weiner, come on up, Mr. Weiner. You have to. It's the rule.
I didn't know I was being that sheepish.
No.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Again, I would like to begin, as opposing counsel Mr. Redding has begun, with what is, I think, dispositive issue as to the collective claims in this case, being as to whether the statute of limitations had run on the assessment of items, attributable partnership items, and the tax-motivated interest. 7422H bars both of those claims for the simple reason that, as to the statute of limitations issue, the statute of limitations is a partnership item. Mr. Redding had just mentioned that there is no dispute that the statute of limitations is an affected item, and he mentioned that in his opening brief, and we had included a footnote to say that that's, in fact, not what we said. It's not what the district court said. And there is a dispute, and the statute of limitations is a partnership item. As to the second issue, as to the tax motive interest, that is an affected item. There is, in fact, no dispute about that. However, taxpayers here challenge the nature of the partnership's transactions, which is the partnership component of an affected item. And because that, too, is attributable to a partnership item, under the plain language of 7422H, that, too, is barred. Now, let me back up a little bit from that and begin with, you know, I'll go through each of the items specifically, beginning with the statute of limitations. The statute of limitations, there is one statute of limitations that is applicable to assessments of tax. And to respond, to take a small detour and respond to something that opposing counsel, has, Mr. Redding, has said in this case, is that there was a tidal shift in how courts thought about the statute of limitations up till 2000 until the present. I would dispute that. If you look to Rome Polenc, which Taxpayers' Council says was sort of the bellwether change, Rome Polenc acknowledges that the tax court had for a long time treated them separately. It just hadn't done it in terms of on the merits holding, and so dealt with it squarely as being a binding decision of the tax court. And if you look at the language of the statute, it seems pretty clear that there's one statute of limitations. 6501 establishes effectively the outer limit of the limitations period. 6229A, or 6229 in its entirety, effectively establishes a minimum period. From the plain language of the statute, 6229A says the limitations period shall not expire before. And so, therefore, in a partnership proceeding, courts address, if a court finds in a partnership-level proceeding that the limitations period is, you know, under 6229 is satisfied, that component of the limitations period, then it does not matter what the partner's personal limitations period under 6501 analysis might be, because all partners, that limitations period is open for all partners. Because if, for example, the partnership issues a, you know, if partnership files its return, 6229A says you have 3 years from the filing of that return. In this case, for example, we use the circumstances of this case. for 1984, which was the 1 year that the statute of limitations is at issue, the tax court in the partnership level proceeding determined that the partnerships had not filed a valid tax return. Under 6229C, that means that the assessments can be made at any time. For 1985, the tax court in the partnership level proceeding determined that the tax matters partner had validly extended the limitations period as provided under 6229B. So hence, the limitations period was open for all partners, because for all partners, the limitations period shall not expire before those periods that were established as being shall not expire before the valid issuance of the FPA. And then finally, I realize that this is a little statutory. We're taking like a rather long discourse through the 6229 rules, but I think it's important is that under 6229D, once the tax court in a partnership proceeding establishes that the FPA was issued within the time period prescribed under 6229, then under subsection D, the IRS has the length of the period until the partnership proceeding is finalized plus 1 year to make the assessments. And so therefore, and there's no dispute that the assessments were made within that 1 year. And so therefore, that ends it. It does not matter what 6501 and individual taxpayers, how that bears on the limitations period. In one sense, Mr. Redding tries to say, well, in Rome Polenc, the court recognized that there's one statute of limitations, but then tries to bifurcate it by saying that 6229 is an affirmative defense to taxpayers' affirmative defense that the limitations period had run. That's not the law, and no court has said that. There is one period in which taxpayers' burden is to establish, if they so raise, a statute of limitations defense that the limitations period had run under 6229 and 6501. If the period hadn't run under 6229, which just establishes the minimum period, then it does not matter what 6501 has to say.
How do you respond to Acute Care's reply brief argument that the IRS never sent appellants, NCAs, or sent out defective NCAs?
My initial response is we think that's only relevant to Mr. Shanahan. As to those other two claims, as to the collective claims of the taxpayers, they're disposed by 7422H and by the res judicata claim that you do not even need to get to if 7422H, we think, correctly does decide this case. As to Mr. Shanahan, the 6 month period under 6230C is triggered by the issuance of a notice of computational adjustment. The notice only needs to achieve, there's no definition, there's no statutory requirements as to the notice.
6231A6, right?
6231, no, I'm sorry. It's 6230C1C, or yes, C1C, I believe, is the 6 month period of limitations that applies to erroneous computations of computational adjustments, which is what Mr. Shanahan's claim is. In fact, if you want me to, I can. I have the TEFRA rules. This is like my little tax litigator Bible right here for TEFRA.
I would like to get that right, along with everything else.
So it's 6230C.
6230C.
C. C.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
So there are no statutory, there's no statutory guidance as to what a notice of computational adjustment must include. Some courts have said that, you know, that has drawn a comparison between a notice of computational adjustment and a notice of deficiency. which strikes me as a reasonable comparison. And the rule is to, and it's an often treated subject in the notice of deficiency context. What the notice of deficiency in this court has said needs to include is that the IRS has determined a deficiency and needs to provide a means of computing what the amount of that deficiency is. Here, we issued a form, we issued two forms to Mr. Shanahan, a form 86, which clearly states, you know, has a brief explanation of the items that he is being assessed for, and also includes a form 4549A, which is effectively a computation, in which it says clearly what his, he's claiming that he in fact is being, that he didn't take the full deductions that he was entitled to under the partnership's return, and so we've effectively overassessed him by $4,000, because he took what his entitled deductions were minus the $4,000. And we assumed he took the full deduction, and so we assessed him for the full amount. Now, we clearly stated the amount that he was being assessed and clearly stated the amount that he was being assessed. And so there doesn't seem to be, I would think, under the current rule, under the current case law, any dispute as to whether there was a notice of computational adjustment as to him. And so that is our answer to that. Going back to the statute of limitations point, just briefly before I move on, is that the code does define what a partnership item is, and you have to effectively meet two. It's under 6231A3. And it says that a partnership item is any item that is taken into account for the partnership's taxable year and has been designated by the IRS as being properly determined on the partnership or on the partnership level as opposed to the partner level. And the statute of limitations meets both that criteria. The statute of limitations affects whether the IRS can adjust partnership items like partnership income, partnership deductions, and so therefore must be taken into account for the partnership's taxable year. And under the Treasury Regulations 301-6231A3-1B, that is that the IRS designates all factual and legal determinations that underlie the determination of partnership items, such as partnerships income, partnerships loss, partnerships deductions, and so on and so forth. And so therefore, it has implicitly, the regulations speak in broad terms because it's capturing a broad swath of things that they're trying to designate as more appropriately determined on the partnership level as opposed to the partner level. The statute of limitations meets that definition, as does moving on to the tax-motivated interest. Taxpayers here are arguing that the tax matters partner and the partners themselves individually did not agree to the fact that there was the partnerships engaged in tax-motivated transactions. That is clearly a partnership item, and I actually don't think the taxpayers dispute that. Their point is that what tax-motivated interest itself is an affected item. We agree, but we just think that that's irrelevant. Under 7422H, you cannot bring a refund claim that is attributable to a partnership item. The fact that there was an agreement or was not an agreement at the partnership level as to the nature of the partnership transactions, that is a partnership item. And so, therefore, their suit is barred by 7422H. That is not to say that there aren't challenges that you can make to tax-motivated interest at the partner level. You can challenge whether there is a substantial underpayment, which is a requirement of imposing such interest. And that, so basically, a substantial underpayment is proof that the taxpayer understated or underpaid their taxes by more than $1,000 on the basis of the tax-motivated transaction. That is going to vary from partner to partner. And so, therefore, is something that you can challenge at the partner level. As well, you can challenge whether the underpayment that the IRS has identified as being in excess of $1,000 is in fact attributable to the partnership's tax-motivated transactions. That is another thing that you can raise at the partner level, and that's what Duffy says. Duffy does not say that you can challenge whether or not there were tax-motivated transactions at the partnership level, because that is common to all partners. It is a partnership item, and so therefore is barred.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just not sure as to the amount of time I have left, and so I think at this point I should.
Yeah.
I have 5 minutes.
5 minutes.
With that in mind, I have a quick res judicata question for you. And I know you don't think we need to get there, but in order to determine the identity of the parties and that they were in fact parties with respect to the partnership level matter, doesn't there have to be some inquiry into the prior proceeding and to some degree?
No, Your Honor. In this proceeding, I think that the time at which you question as to who the appropriate partners are, I believe this gets to the requirement under 6226D. That the partners have to have an interest in the partnership level proceeding in order to be treated as bound by that proceeding. And because the statute of limitations is a partnership item, that if their claim is that our limitations period had run, that is an argument that you assert at the partnership level. Because the tax court can determine yay or nay whether your limitations period had run. And if your limitations period had, in fact, run, then it dismisses you from the suit, and the IRS doesn't go after you after the partnership proceeding is finished for whatever repercussions the partnership proceeding wrought. You cannot do what taxpayers have done here, which is sit on the sideline, figure out how things shake out at the partnership level, and then assert that your limitations period had run on the partner level because you don't necessarily like the result.
Doesn't the district court here have to examine the prior proceeding to some extent before it can determine that it does not have jurisdiction? Doesn't it have to look at it to some extent?
Well, I think the court did look at it to some extent. The court, I think correctly, said the part of each of the decisions of the partnerships at issue here was that the limitations period, the FPAW was validly issued under 6229 for the partnerships for the partnerships in which 1984 was a tax year at issue and 1985 was the tax year at issue. That means that all partners, because that establishes the minimum period for a statute of limitations, that means that all partners and those partnerships were bound by the determination. And at the very least, in a partnership-level proceeding, as we mentioned in our 20HA letter, courts always have jurisdiction to determine whether they have jurisdiction. So at the partnership-level proceeding is when you go to a court and you say, you know, my individual period has run. I mean, that is a frivolous argument in this case because of 6229 and the court's determination that, in fact, everybody's period is still open because the minimum the 6229 minimum is met. But that's an issue these are all arguments that you make at the partnership level. As to the court's inquiry, is once the court established that the 6229, if the 6229 rules hadn't been met, nobody's statute of limitations was open, the whole matter would have been dismissed. Everything after that is an advisory opinion. And so the fact that the court issued a final determination adjusting various partnership items and the fact that no individual partners were dismissed because of their limitations period, then that's the end of the inquiry. There is no there is nothing more for a court at the partner level to do or can do.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Unless there are any other questions.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. How much time? Oh, I'm going to give you a couple of minutes.
I'll make it very, very brief. Frankly, I could take 2 hours to rebut that, but if there are some things I simply want to make absolutely clear. One, the lower courts to which these partners were subject, the decisions to which these partners were subject and cases they were involved in, if they were subject at all, never made determinations that the extension, that there were valid extensions of the statute of limitations, or that the statute of or that the return was invalid. Those are determinations made in cases for other partnerships. They are not relevant to this case. And the facts could be completely different in these partnerships. The government says under 6226 they were all partners, but it omits reference to the portion of 6226 that says if the statute of limitations ran, they can't participate. So how do you raise that? And that is jurisdictional, and under Henderson and under the recent opinion in Minkim in this court, even if there were prior determinations along those lines in other courts, they ought to be reconsidered now under Henderson, because that is a jurisdictional statute. And it's a jurisdictional statute that says if their limitations period ran, they can't participate. As to the six-month argument, the government's analysis of that statute omits two things. It relies on a statute that says that it's 6 months if the claim is attributable to an erroneous computation of a computational adjustment. There's no claim of an erroneous computation here. In 97, the court added another subsection to that statute for claims that are attributable to assessments erroneously imposed following a TEFRA proceeding and made those subject to 6 months, which this would qualify under, except that limited six-month statute only applies to tax years after 1997. Compare the two statutes. Erroneous computation, the government would have us read the words erroneous computation out of the section it relies on and make it say any erroneous computational adjustment. That's just flat wrong. If you can't go back and look at what was decided in the decision or what was decided in a settlement and when it's applied to the taxpayer, then how can the taxpayer ever say, you misapplied it to me? The government says you can't ever challenge that. That's wrong, and that's what Duffy says you can do. And Duffy does say you conduct the res judicata analysis to determine whether or not there was content in that decision that bound the taxpayer to the proposition the government wants to bind him to. And Duffy is very good reasoning.
Forgive me on that, but I really would like to. It seems to me that Section 7422H doesn't permit an exception when the taxpayer claims not to be bound by the partnership level determination. How could res judicata operate here? And even if it did, it seems to me the government would win because the proceedings here arose from the same transaction or the same core of operative facts. And the parties are identical or in privity with the ones on the partnership level proceedings.
That's a mixed bag, Your Honor. There were multiple partnerships with cases going forward. There were some specific factual determinations made with regard to, I think, 3 of 40 partnerships. The government wants to incorporate those decisions as if they applied to the partnerships these partners are in. These partners were not in those partnerships. So as far as the interlocutory rulings in those cases, they can't apply to these partners. And the decision, if you restrict the review to the decision that was entered, it does not contain a determination that there were valid extensions of the statute. It does not contain a determination of a tax-motivated transaction. But that is the review the lower court should have conducted, because that's our claim, is that there was no basis in the decisions that were entered for the government to have made these assessments, and there was no defense to the statute of limitations established in those decisions.
Yeah, but didn't the stipulation say plainly and simply, and I'm quoting now, that the parties stipulate and agree that the outcome of the statute of limitations issues presented in the rest of the cases will be determined in a manner consistent with the court's findings of fact and law on the statute of limitations.
I agree, Your Honor. However, first I'll say I don't know that that stipulation can be binding under the TEFRA rules. The TMP can't bind the notice partners to something like that. But even if it is, that's a whole different argument for a whole different brief. Even if it is binding, look at the language. It doesn't say, and on other things they said he would agree he'd be bound to the same determinations. Here it says, as to the statute of limitations, he agrees to be bound that it will be determined in the same manner as. That means we're going to go in and look and see if it was a valid tax return in 84. That means we're going to go in and look, partnership by partnership, at whether or not there was a valid extension for the 85 cases. That never subsequently happened. There is no determination that in these partnerships there was, in fact, an extension of the statute for the 85 years or that the partnership returns were invalid for 84. It doesn't exist. And the stipulation at trial going into some of the test cases limited the statute of limitations stipulation to merely resolve the other partnerships in a manner consistent with. It didn't agree to bind them to the determination as to that partnership. And I think that's crucial. You can't expand it to say whatever they decided based on the facts about Mr. Jones, even though we'd have to look to see if the facts are the same as Mr. Smith, we're now going to say, oh, Mr. Jones' determination applies to Mr. Smith. That's what the government's asking you to do. It never happened. They never made the determination in a manner consistent with. It doesn't exist.
Thank you.
Thank you for the extra time, Your Honor. I wish I had an hour to spend on this.
Who wants to be here for hours in front of us? Oh, my goodness. My goodness. Texas. Wow. All right. Thank you very, very much to both parties. And have good trips back. And the case will be taken under advisement.